Welcome to the REI Rookies Podcast,
the Real Estate Investing Rookies Podcast, episode number 3, where we invite you to follow us on our journey toward financial freedom using the power of real estate. I'm Josh Koth.
And I'm Jack Haas.
Jack, what do we got going on this week?
Well, I thought we would spend a little time this week talking about how we define what makes a good deal.
Yes, because one thing you'll come across in all your education pursuits of real estate is, you know, all these different options of finding properties, how to find properties. You know, you got people coming at you with referrals. You got, you know, mail campaigns, bandit signs, all these other things, Craigslist. Well, how do you know if something is a good deal? If someone says, I'll sell you my house for $100,000, how do you know if you should say yes or no to that, or make a counteroffer, or be excited because that's an amazing price? How do you even know, right?
Yeah, and when we calculate our numbers, we kind of come about it a little backwards in the fact that we will start at our rental price if we're going to buy and hold it.
Mm-hmm.
We want to make sure that the purchase price justifies the return, that monthly return. So we really see there's really 4 exit strategies for every property. And as such, we likely will calculate 4 numbers for each property just to make sure that we have everything covered.
Yep. And just to, we're going to do an episode on each one of these strategies coming up here. But the first one is called wholesaling. So that's basically you find a property, get it under contract, and then you sell it to another investor, typically, or even somebody that wants to live in it for a kind of a finder's fee. The second one is called quick flip. That's where you find a property and then sell it again without doing anything to it. You just got it cheap enough where there was a spread there. And fix and flip, or rehabbing or flipping, that's where you purchase a property, actually do a rehab to it, and then sell it on the open market, retail market as we call it. And the fourth one is buy and hold. That's where you purchase a property and it may or may not need a rehab, but your strategy is to hold on to it long term and collect that rental income. So we're going to do an episode on each one of those strategies, but that's basically our main 4. And you know what the key is to making all 4 of those work, the magic bullet that will make all 4, any one of those 4 work? Tell me, Jack.
Buying it at the right price.
Yes. Buying it cheap, because if you do that, all things are possible. you know, there's that saying in real estate, you make your money when you buy, right?
And that's definitely the truth, especially in any of these categories.
Yep. Because no matter how gold-plated you make every fixture and, you know, the best upgrades possible, if your house is in a certain neighborhood, it's only going to bring a certain amount of value. You can only push that to a certain limit. So once you know that upper cap, you know, if on the retail market, for instance, if you're going to sell to an end buyer that's going to live in it, it's only going to, that neighborhood will only support a certain amount of house, a certain price. So that's where you have to start. So yeah, so basically all things are possible if you buy it cheap enough. That's what you have to know. But how do you know what is cheap enough? So basically you start with the starting price or what it'll rent for if you're going to buy and hold, and work backwards from there. And we'll go into all these strategies and how each one has what is an acceptable ROI in our minds, anyways, in our market, for each one of those strategies. But basically what you want to do is exceed all other areas and strategies that you could do with your money. Let's say you had your money in a 401k in the stock market, etc. Well, what's a good ROI there? You know, what's a guaranteed type of ROI? 4%, 5%, 6%, something like that. Has that been your experience, Jack?
Yeah, well, if I was lucky. But I think what's really important to note is that we shouldn't get caught up on the asking price. You know, we have a lot of luck actually in our market to even find some of these properties through the MLS.
Mm-hmm.
We generally ignore the asking price.
Yes. The asking price for us is merely a suggestion. we look at what other properties in the area have sold for currently and in what condition those were in, and if they had similar, you know, comps, as they call it, if they comparables. And, you know, we start there. And what they're asking is irrelevant, because if you walk into a place and it needs a ton of upgrades, well, that asking price, you know, you got to knock those upgrades right off the top, right?
Yeah, and we're going to get into a lot more detail regarding how we calculate, do quick calculations on a lot of these things. Mm-hmm. When we go and look at a property too, we don't spend a ton of time in each one. No. And we have a fairly strong idea of what it's going to cost to rehab those properties.
Yep, and there's all kinds of quick little rules of thumb and formulas you can use to guesstimate things. But the main thing is, once you walk through a ton of properties, you'll get just much better and quicker at figuring those numbers. So basically, as far as ROI goes, you know, you want to figure out, okay, every dollar that I'm putting into this project, what is it going to bring me back, right? And buy and hold, that's a cash on cash ROI. That's something you figure. And wholesaling, okay, it's a quicker option. How much time does it take to do the wholesale? What am I going to get? What's my finder's fee? What's my wholesaling fee? It might be, it might take 30 days if you make $5,000. Okay, is that an acceptable time to generate that type of money? In the quick flip or fix and flip scenarios, how long did those flips take? From the time you started looking for them till the time you get the check at the closing table? What's an acceptable amount of income for that time? So that's all things you have to figure out. And there's some kind of industry standard numbers and some local market, you know, standards we can talk about as we dive into each one of those strategies in upcoming episodes. But that's all things you have to really keep in mind, because as an example, would it be a good use of your time if it took you, 10,000 hours to find one property and flip it for $1,000 profit, or wholesale it for $1,000. No, that wouldn't be a great use of your time. It wouldn't be a good return on your investment. So you have to really understand what your numbers are and what's an acceptable deal to you. So when you start to go out and find these deals, you can analyze them quickly and determine and filter out the ones that aren't and move on to, and spend the time on the ones that will be.
I think what you're going to find too is that we do have a lot of focus on the value of our time. So we will be placing a lot of a dollar amount, if you will, a return on that investment. Mm-hmm. Our time is as much value as the money we put into a deal.
Yep, exactly. And when you're doing rehabs, especially, you'll find, especially if you're a do-it-yourselfer, a lot of people won't figure in their own time installing things, painting, doing the rehab. And that's crucial. You have to account for that time, because that's, if you would have had to hire that out, that's money you would have had to have paid. And it's time you could have spent doing other things. So you have to account for that time. So whenever we do a rehab, we always account for our hours and pay ourselves a nominal wage just to at least track the true cost of what that rehab was. And we'll get into that when we talk about fixing and flipping.
So, well, do we want to just jump into like some personal experiences here now, that what's going on in our market and what we're dealing with?
You betcha.
And I know you're looking forward to this part, right, Josh? You have an interesting situation or two.
Yeah. So, one of the things you'll deal with when you have buy and holds is evictions. Dun, dun, dun. So right now we have a nice gentleman that decided he wouldn't pay his rent last month. So we, my property manager, and I don't manage this property because as an investor, you really don't want to manage your own properties. That's one of the only ways you can scale. So my property manager, she knows how to handle these types of things, evictions. She has a lawyer, has all the proper paperwork and everything recorded, all the notes, proper notes and canceled checks, signed leases, all the documentation and everything needed to present a case to a judge. So unfortunately, tomorrow at 3:00, I'm going to witness in court my first eviction. So that'll be interesting to see how that goes down. I normally wouldn't attend, but I kind of want to just be there to see how it goes down, see if the tenant shows up, see what they say, see what the judge says. So this will be, well, actually my second time evicting someone. The first time I wasn't present as I was out of town. So it'll be an interesting experience, and we'll we'll let you know what happens on the next episode.
Yeah, that'll be a good follow-up. So with that, some other things, experiences we've had. Let's focus on the quick and flip idea. You know, one of them is that we acquired a property here in the Fargo market, and we are selling it right now. We close on it actually here next week. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that was we're going to call it the quick flip, where we didn't really put a lot of time, money, or anything into this as we sold it through a real estate agent. Mm-hmm. And we made it a part of the contingency. One of the things that it needed was some bracing in the basement.
Yeah, in this area of town, a lot of the houses are 100 years old, around that time, built around that time period. So a lot of the, in the upper Midwest here, a lot of the basements start caving in at that point. So if you look at houses in the built in the 1910s, 1920s, they almost always have crumbling in basement walls or have been braced. And actually, a previous deal had fallen apart because of that issue upon inspection. So we made that a contingency of us purchasing it. And since the seller had had a one deal fall through, they were much more willing to complete that for us. And they did. And that was great because we were able to, and this is also speaks to our strategy of if you buy it cheap enough, you can use any strategy, any exit strategy you like. So we decided to quick flip this one, extract the cash, the profit equity from it. And we literally just had it cleaned by a house cleaner, and that's all we've done. And the funny, the flip side of this quick flip, and you know, the proof of just, it never hurts to ask. Well, our buyers had an inspection done, and they had a couple things they wanted done. They wanted a gutter added, a window fixed, and they asked us if we would, and we said, okay. So we were victims of that, or not victims, but we were on the receiving end of that strategy as well. So, you know, we can testify to both sides of that equation that it never hurts to ask, because that's the only way you're going to get something, right?
That's right, and that kind of leads into our Coach's Corner this week. We really are starting to believe in this, the Aladdin theory. Isn't that the book that you read?
Yeah. For Coach's Corner this week, the book I wanted to recommend is called The Aladdin Factor, How to Ask for and Get Everything You Want by Jack Canfield. And this is a great, it's great in audiobook form. He reads it as a very expressive voice. And it's really just all about, you know, achieving personal happiness, creative fulfillment, professional success, freedom from fear, and anything is possible if you dare to ask. And he gives lots of stories and examples of this, and you'll find that if you just ask for something that you like, worst case scenario is you get turned down, right? Well, best case scenario is you receive what you asked for. So if you just start asking more often, you'll receive what you'd like more often than not, typically. And Jack, you had a good story about how you put this into practice recently with, was it a cable provider?
Well, are you referring to the Echo?
Oh, yeah, with Amazon. Yep, yeah, exactly.
So we have one of those Amazon Echoes, and it died not just recently, and it's out of warranty. So when I called in on that, of course, they were nice enough to offer me a discount, but frankly, it was only going to be like $20. Those things are about $180 now. But when I just simply asked if there was anything that the representative could do to help me out, in the end, make a long story short, I ended up with an Echo for $30.
That's great, because if you were going to, technically, it was out of warranty, so they could have said, sorry, you just have to purchase a new one for $180, right?
Yep.
So effectively, you got a discount of $150, which is, you know, what, 80% or something?
Yep.
You know, by just asking repeatedly, and you didn't stop at level one. He gave you a discount immediately. You asked, like, got two more levels of discount by being persistent. And, you know, some people may not be comfortable with that. you know, if it's for a friend or a personal acquaintance, but if you're talking to a call center representative, you may have more comfort level just asking, because what are they going to do? Be mad at you?
That's I think I saw this as kind of a learning experience. I'm really forcing myself lately to ask more.
Yep.
Because as like you said, what damage does it really do other than I'm still in the same situation as I was before?
Yep. First asking. That really can be reflected in negotiations, right? When you're trying to acquire properties and you're negotiating with a seller, always ask for a discount, because why not? The worst they can do is say no. And then if you decide the property is still a good deal, you can still say, okay, I'll accept your original price or my last offer or whatever price you had originally agreed upon. But it never hurts to always ask. I would never pay the asking price on a property unless there was, multiple offers in your bidding situation, a bidding war or something like that. But if it's just you and the seller, or if you're talking to an off-market seller, if somebody gives you a price, well, that's just a suggestion, right? We always offer lower than that. Even if we think their price is a fair price, a good deal, we may end up there, but we always will start lower than that. So that's just another thing to always put into practice. And I think people understand that when they're selling a house and they name a price, they know that's not going to be the final price. So that's kind of built in. So people are expecting to come down a little bit.
So, well, that's going to probably conclude this episode of REI Rookies. You can find us on Twitter or send us any questions via Twitter at REI Rookies. And remember, get off the bench.
And get into the game. Get out there. We'll see you next time. Really? I forgot that's my cue.
So, Josh, what kind of return on investment do you think? Well, we're going to have to edit this piece out.